Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the Natural Gas Programme at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Bassam Fatou, Adem Irasilovich, who's research associate, and Mikhail Maiden, who is director of the China Programme at the OIES. And we're here to discuss the key messages that came from the recent papers, Nigerian Barrels and the Demand Shock, Differentials and Changing Oil Trade Flows, that was published in June 2020, Middle East Benchmarks and the Oil Demand Shock, that was published a month later in July 2020, and the Shanghai Oil Futures Contract and the Oil Demand Shock, that was published last week, the 31st of July. Just to let you know, we're recording this on the 3rd of August, and I like to say that timeline because this market is changing so quickly. Anyway, Bassam, nice to have you here. Can I ask you the first question? In your papers, you always emphasize the point that although benchmarks came under stress during the 2020 market crisis, the market did work. Now, that said, I was interested that the third paper opens, the global oil demand shock due to the COVID-19 pandemic has sent markets and benchmarks into turmoil. Can you please elaborate on that?
Thank you, David, for the kind invitation. It's really a great pleasure to be joining this podcast with Mikhail and Adi. Despite the severity of the demand shock, the oil market did perform exceptionally well, reflecting its maturity and depth. In effect, due to the large demand shock that we have witnessed due to the pandemic, we ended up with a massive oversupply coming to the market, particularly in the month of April. The main concern at that time was whether the oil market, with its physical and financial infrastructure, could cope with this massive oversupply. Well, the market did cope well, and various price relationships had to adjust to make this happen. For instance, we saw the time spreads shifting from backwardation to steep contango to give the incentive for storage both on land and on ships, and for crude and products. Also, as the oil price fell to very low levels, to send signals to producers to cut output, either on a voluntary or non-voluntary basis. The physical differentials and freight rates also adjusted to make certain crudes more competitive and allowing crude to flow from surplus areas to where it's needed. In this respect, China played a key role as an absorption mechanism, particularly for Nigerian barrels, an issue which we discuss in detail in one of our papers. So having said that, the majority of the benchmark came under severe stress. The negative pricing of WTI was a key moment for the oil market. But looking at other benchmarks, they also came under pressure. For instance, at one point, Brent futures dislocated from dated Brent, but thanks to other layers such as contract for differences or what is known as CFDs, they did the heavy stretching and some market participants were able to continue to hedge. In the Gulf, there was a huge divergence between oil benchmarks that were supposed to measure the value of the same type of crude. And in China, the Shanghai contract overshot all the other benchmarks at one point due to massive demand from retail investors, a point that Mikhail and Adi discuss in their paper in more details. So all of these call for reflection on what happened and to try to draw some lessons for the future of oil benchmarks. And the series of papers we publish at the Institute is precisely to contribute to this debate.
Yeah, well, I have to say, Bassam, I'm an old oil trader. I traded oil years ago, but I found the papers really, really fascinating. But one thing you just mentioned, you know, was the role of the Chinese companies. So, Adi, can I come to you? Because, you know, the large surge of Chinese companies buying Nigerian oil in the kind of April to June 2020 period, was it just a matter of price that drove them to buy the volumes?
Thank you, David. Traditionally, China buys Nigerian barrels, but not in similar quantities. Normally, they buy about 50,000 barrels a day, and that was the last year figure. But this time in May, for example, they bought five times as much. That was astonishing. So it was really the delivered price that was the key, and a little bit of timing. China emerged from the pandemic, and then Europe just entered the same pandemic. And Europe is traditional market for those barrels. So Nigerian barrels were available in volume, no destination restrictions, and at distressed prices.
It did. You clearly mentioned the expression delivered price. So how important were the low freight rates at that time?
Well, it's extremely important. For an end user, delivered price is really what matters. Freight rates were key. Early in April, the rates actually did shoot up, but then they came sharply down, and there was an opportunity to lock in some really cheap freight. And what also, David, what also helps was that, you know, Nigerian barrels do traditionally get shipped in LR2s and VLCCs, so they're kind of ready packaged to go east.
It's a long haul, so they're big cargoes. Mikhail, coming to you, you know, China imports, you know, played a key role in the market rebalancing and absorbing Nigerian barrels, as we've heard. But is this going to continue, do you think?
So there's the issue of the Nigerian barrels that was contingent on the factors that Adi has described. And when market continues allow, China will continue to buy those. And there's the quality of the crude and sort of China's own shift to light ends, which will be supportive for Nigerian barrels. And I think, of course, you know, Nigerian barrels are interesting as a bellwether for global markets, but they are, as Adi just said, a small share of China's imports. And when we look more broadly at April to June, China bought just under an incremental 2 million barrels a day. So that's 2 million barrels a day more than last year, roughly equivalent to the entire Nigerian production. And this was positive for Brazilian grades, North Sea, Russian grades. It was helpful for the entire market to absorb the overhang. But what we're seeing now is a little bit of indigestion in China. Pipelines into the continent are full, the port, floating storage. So I think in the near term, buying will have to slow just as China digests all these volumes. But I think more broadly, and part of the point of all these papers, is that China has accounted for the bulk of incremental crude demand globally over the past sort of decade. It remains the largest importer globally. And that is, of course, key for all producers. Again, if we look at Q2, when China not only started to emerge from the COVID-19 demand slump, but also was able to benefit from the low oil prices, it imported an additional 1.3 million barrels a day of Middle Eastern crudes alone. Again, that's kind of the equivalent of Angolan production. But for Middle Eastern producers, again, which are kind of the bedrock of Chinese supplies, that's huge.
Well, Bassam, can I come back to you and maybe move our focus a little bit to the Middle East? How did the Middle Eastern benchmarks fare with such severe demand shock in the last few months?
Well, David, the demand shock did not spare the Middle East benchmarks. And this has to do in large part with the fact that the decline in oil demand did not affect all parts of the barrel in the same way. Demand for gasoline and jet fuel were hit the hardest during the lockdown. Basically, people were not driving or flying. And this in turn hit harder those crudes with high yields of those products. Now, in the Gulf, there are three key oil benchmarks. You have Platts Oman, Platts Dubai, and DME Oman. DME stands for Dubai Mercantile Exchange. The price reporting agency Platts prices its crude on the basis of a basket, which includes Dubai, Upper Zakum, Oman, Al Shaheen, and Merban. All of these are crudes produced by the various Gulf exporters. Now, Merban is interesting. It's a light crude with high sulfur, and it has a low yield of fuel oil and very high yields of jet fuel and naphtha. Under normal market conditions, given its better quality, Merban traditionally trades at a premium to the other crudes in the basket, and therefore it does not set the price of Platts Oman or Platts Dubai. But during the crisis, refineries shied away from this crude, and it became the cheapest in the basket, and he started setting the price for Platts Oman. Now, this is in contrast to the DME Oman only because DME Oman has only one underlying crude, which is the Oman crude, a medium sour grade. Given that Platts Oman was reflecting Merban, while DME Oman was reflecting Oman, the price of these two benchmarks diverged widely, with Platts Oman pricing much lower than DME Oman at one point. And in the past, the price difference between the two was in cents, and during the crisis, the difference became in dollars.
But this must also have complicated Middle East oil exporters' efforts for setting OSPs as well, mustn't it, Bassam?
Absolutely. For Middle East oil exporters, this created a headache. In pricing their exports to Asia, for instance, Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, they use a formula that includes both Platts Oman and DME Oman. In other words, in the same formula, there are two benchmarks with completely different characteristics. So when setting their official selling prices or OSPs, they had to take into account the weakness of Platts Oman and had to adjust their OSPs even sharper than what was expected. For others such as Iraqi, which use only Platts Oman and whose crude exports are mainly medium sour, pricing on the basis of light Murban was not ideal, and they too had to push their OSP's premiums quite high.
Well, Adi, can I come to you? Because I want to pick up on this theme which Bassam's been raising. You know, what are there any changes that the price reporting agencies could implement to actually overcome some of these problems?
Absolutely, David. Clearly, from what Bassam's just said, the problem is very technical. If you look at the Dubai basket, Murban is really an odd one out, and it was an odd one out before, which Platts knew. It traded about two, or sometimes even higher, $2 a barrel higher than Dubai, and he had something called QP or quality premium to adjust it to do a quality adjustment to the rest of the basket. Now, for the reasons, again, that Bassam pointed out in terms of products values, Murban started trading below Dubai, and this QP became redundant. However, really, the solution is pretty straightforward. One is a radical one, either to take Murban out of the basket and just get rid of it because it is an odd one out, spoiling the pricing. The simplest solution, which Bassam and I suggested in our paper, was basically to introduce a negative QP. Negative prices do happen, as we know, and negative QP would be a very simple and easy solution for Platts to implement and actually adjust for the difference.
That's an interesting concept. So, Bassam, can I come back to you on another point which you discussed in the paper? You know, I remember when I traded oil back in the 80s, netback pricing was really very popular. So should the value of benchmarks be driven by refinery yields and netback prices effectively?
That's a good question, David, because one of the arguments made is that by Murban pushing the benchmark prices down, this improved the refining margins in Asia, which is good for refiners. It's also good for producers as it ensures that they retain market share in a key market. But I'm not convinced that benchmarks should be priced to ensure positive refining margins, especially in the current context. Just to remind everyone, in 1986, Saudi Arabia tried the netback pricing system, which essentially you price your crude to ensure refining margins stay positive. The reason they adopted this system was to restore market share at the time after they saw their production decline very sharply. But I would argue that the context nowadays is fundamentally different. Unlike 1986, Saudi Arabia is engaging in a historic protection cut to try to balance the market and lift prices.
It's a different time, isn't it, really? That's what you're saying.
It's a completely different context than the 1986.
Well, look, why don't we move the discussion now to perhaps east and start discussing kind of the Shanghai International Energy Exchange, INE, which is discussed in several of the papers. And so, Adi, can I ask you, how did the INE perform during the demand shock? Or was it another victim to the challenging market?
Well, I'm afraid it was. It was that crazy week when WTI, and we spoke about that a lot, went to almost minus $40 a barrel. Yeah. And roughly in the same week, INE actually held a premium over DME Oman at about $14 higher, even though Oman is deliverable into that contract. And obviously, there was a major arbitrage open. And for a while, it took a lot of players by surprise, big surprise. But very soon, the market, as Bassam said at the beginning, markets worked. What happened? The Chinese traders, international traders stepped up and closed the arbitrage by buying in April. They could buy June DME barrels and deliver them into July DME contract. And that differential actually closed very soon. And we saw delivery of almost 40 million barrels of physical oil into DME. And that's really what sparked this whole discussion.
Mikhail, perhaps you can give us a little background. The Chinese Shanghai International Energy Exchange, INE, is a relative newcomer. Can you perhaps give us some background as to why it was set up and how it operates?
Sure. I mean, the idea was not new, even though the benchmark itself is 2 years old. But the idea has been really floating around for years. And fundamentally, it's because China has wanted to assert its pricing power globally and to create a benchmark that's reflective of Asian buyer fundamentals, because obviously that's where demand is globally. And it's very different from North Sea and WTI, because the Chinese diet and the Asian diet really is medium sour crudes, whereas the other benchmarks are sort of lighter crudes. the other factors that have gone into the thinking behind the Shanghai Exchange, one is financial market liberalization, and the other is a desire to trade in the Chinese currency and to try and set about sort of an alternative trading mechanism to the US dollar. And that's something that, especially now in the context of US-China trade war, is incredibly appealing both to the Chinese leadership, but also when we think about the smaller independent traders and independent refiners in China working with the Chinese currency and being able to avoid sort of complicated forex hedges, that is something that in theory is very appealing to them.
Following on that from that in theory point, you know, what are the aspirations and challenges regarding the INE?
Well, I guess the currency convertibility is really one of the biggest hindrances. Again, in theory, over time, it will be hugely appealing. But right now, for a number of, I guess, for large traders that have an exposure and a footprint in China, it's not too difficult to work with the currency and to hedge it. But really, with the lack of convertibility, that's one of the issues. The other is that the financial markets are still relatively limited. I mean, up until now, what this latest lesson has shown was that the INE was able to adapt very quickly because physical deliveries were seen when it launched as a huge hurdle. And actually, we've seen the storage expand massively. We will now have to see how that filters through into the country and how smooth that process will be.
Adi, coming back to you on the kind of the INE, you know, while the global demand shock bolstered the prospects for the, you know, the Chinese INE contract, well, you know, do you think it was a blip or a trend? Is there a room, do you think, for other benchmarks for oil delivered into China? What do you think?
Well, it's a great question, David. I mean, as we said in the paper, Michelle and I, the jury's out. Very much depends on sort of further developments, particularly regarding storage, logistics, pipeline logistics, and some other possible tax and refinery margin guarantees, which the government gives to the Chinese refiners if the oil falls below $40. But, you know, also in terms of logistics to begin with, INE had no tanks in Shandong, and the cost delivering oil there from the existing tankage was very, very expensive, limiting the independent refiners' appetite for involvement in the INE. And there were the INE, to be fair, was very quick to add the sort of physical deliveries to Shandong and Liaodong provinces from new tankage, which they leased, covering the independent refineries. So that's certainly an opportunity. But an interesting one is also, David, the possibility for another contract as well on INE, and that's the potential sort of sweet contract which would apply to medium sweet crudes such as Brazilian Lula, Russia Mespo, and Congolese Geno. They're very, very popular grades, both with state, sort of Chinese majors and refiners. And there exist excellent PRA assessments for those grades. And some sort of index that would mark these grades would be a very, very interesting addition to the INE contract.
Mikhail, just coming back to you, you know, reading the paper, which I have to say really enjoyed all three papers, it was really interesting. I liked your comment that you said even though the INE is still far from being a benchmark, this should not be mistaken for China's lack of pricing power in the global market. And I was just wondering, you know, is this just another case of the importance of China as an oil buyer, like we've seen in the gas and the coal sectors?
I mean, absolutely. You know, and we've been highlighting, and Adi's been writing about this for a while, you know, the importance of China as a pricing power. I think COVID-19 certainly highlighted China's ability to move markets just by the sheer weight sort of and size of its purchases. The fact that it did absorb a huge chunk of the incremental volumes points to that. But China's weight in global markets is a function of a number of things. It's, again, just the size of its economy. And we see the Chinese trade data moves oil prices just because of sentiment. But equally, you know, Bassam was talking about DME Oman versus Platts Oman. The Chinese traders, and we talk about this in the paper, they're two of the three largest sort of players on the Platts window. And equally, 70 or 80% of Omani crudes goes to China. I mean, there's part of it is playing the benchmarks or being accustomed to sort of using the benchmark. Part of it is just being extremely active. And it's not just sort of China Inc., the major state-owned companies. It's also the independents that are effectively trading off Brent and impacting Brent. And for some other crudes like Lula, that they are the biggest buyer of, even though these might be niche crudes and there isn't a global market for them, they effectively set these prices.
It's interesting because you mentioned the independent oil companies. And I just wondered, What is their role? You know, will they support the development of the INE?
It's been an interesting one for the independents because since the majors were involved in creating and sort of establishing the INE and especially the storage tanks, they did really gear it up to benefit themselves, to benefit the majors rather than the independents. We mustn't forget that the relationship between the majors and the independents is one of extreme competition. And so in theory, it could benefit the independents. Again, we discussed the currency, we discussed the ability to source from different providers globally. But the majors haven't really wanted that. But what has just happened, and especially the emergence of storage space in Shandong and Liaoning, which are kind of the provinces that serve the independent market, it could end up helping the independents develop and grow and perhaps use this bench, sort of the exchange more actively. But that's, as Adi was saying, that's where kind of the jury is out and we need to see what happens next.
Adi, just coming back to you on something you said, you talked about the potential maybe for new contracts and, you know, different contracts on the INE. You know, so I was just wondering, could the INE become the basis of a regional oil pricing index? What do you think?
Well, David, I mean, there's absolutely no reason why INE crude contract shouldn't be something like WTI in the United States, a very strong, very powerful regional index, pricing index. Whether that happens or not really depends very much on everything, Michal and I just said, very much on the support of the majors, Chinese majors, as well as the government, independent refiners. We need some further infrastructure improvements, and the devil's really in the detail, including credit, currency convertibility, and general market liberalization.
But Sam, I'd like to come back to you for the last question, if I may, because, you know, I think you always know I like to end podcasts which I record by trying to look forward. And what are the indicators that our listeners need to watch to monitor the recovery from where we are today? What's your view on that?
Well, first is the time spreads. And there are indications that these are weakening. For instance, Dubai recently has shifted from backwardation to contango. And if inventory starts building up again due to a weaker demand recovery, this will be reflected in a deeper contango over time. The second one is the physical differentials. A few weeks ago, sour crudes such as Russian Urals were trading at a record premiums, but these are now weakening. As OPEC Plus eases its cut and China buying starts easing, this should result in further softening of the medium sour crude differentials. Adi mentioned how Chinese demand supported the value of Nigerian crudes, which in a way strengthened the light sweet differentials. But these differentials are also weakening, indicating that China's appetite for Nigerian crude is also waning, and European refineries are not perhaps picking up the slack. And finally, you have to look at gasoline and diesel margins, particularly in Asia. And these are also showing signs of weakness. I think that the sharp rise in refinery runs and imports in China gave the impression that China is experiencing a V-shaped recovery. But if domestic demand turns out to be weaker than originally thought, and I suspect this is the case, this means product exports from China will rise, depressing refining margins in Asia, which could eventually feed into crude pricing and OSPs. To me, this suggests that we are going through a weak patch and the road to recovery is highly uneven. And at the start of the crisis, we saw some disconnect between physical prices and futures prices. And we may be witnessing a similar episode, but nowhere near as extreme as before. But what this shows is the importance of China as a key player in the oil pricing and trade flows. And as Adi and Michal argued in their paper, this is regardless of the future of the INE contract becoming a global benchmark. The challenge to me has always been is how to reflect this increasing power without distorting the underlying benchmarks. And that's why PRAs and exchanges really need to continue to innovate and adjust, basically.
Fascinating. Well, look, Michal, Bassam and Adi, thank you so much for your time today. I've really enjoyed the insights that you've shared with us. And the conversation builds on the messages from your three recently published papers on oil benchmarks and contracts. I hope you have enjoyed listening to this podcast, and thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts as well as all our written research on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.